Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. November 5th is still many months away, but it feels like election season is taking off in the United States. Earlier this month, U.S. President Joe Biden delivered his 2024 State of the Union address. From a foreign policy perspective, he spoke about Ukraine, the Middle East, and immigration. But perhaps most tellingly, the address itself felt a bit like a campaign speech. Meanwhile, the Republican field has cleared up, and Donald Trump is almost certainly the party's nominee. His speeches are always campaign events. As the race for the White House intensifies, one of the things I wanted to explore today is how the campaign trail impacts foreign policy choices. For example, will public perception on a particular issue, say the Middle East, shape how the White House thinks about it? Or is there a threshold for that to happen? What are the historical precedents? These are all good questions to pose to my guest this week. Richard Haass is the President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. He led CFR with distinction for 20 years and as such very much represents the foreign policy establishment. Before his time at CFR, he was Director of Policy Planning at the State Department. We're releasing this episode a few days early. Things are just moving so quickly in the news right now. Remember, if you like this podcast, you can also try us on video, live on foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to ask questions too. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. Let's dive in. Richard Haass, welcome to FP Live.
Great to be with you, Robbie.
So let's start with the Middle East. You wrote a really strong essay in the Wall Street Journal last week. It was titled, "The War That Israel Could Have Fought." And you say that after October 7, almost all of Israel's choices have been counterproductive. Explain that.
Well, I thought that Israel had to respond. To use language I am comfortable with, it was a war of necessity for Israel to respond. But there was a wide range of possibilities as to what it actually did. For example, its use of military force. It could have been much more targeted. Much more with small units rather than with various types of aerial bombardment, which was sure to cause large numbers of civilian casualties. Israel could have been much more forthcoming on opening up land routes for humanitarian assistance. Above all, Israel could have introduced a significant political track. Basically, you know, the parallel here I have, Robbie, is from my time as the U.S. envoy in Northern Ireland. And what the British did in Northern Ireland is they introduced a significant police and military presence during the three decades of the Troubles, from the late 60s to the late 90s. But they also opened up a political track. And what they essentially told the Provisional IRA and other paramilitaries is, look, you will never shoot your way to power. You will never shoot your way to realizing your agenda. But if you give up shooting, if you give up arms, you hand them over, you enter the political track, you may not get everything you want, but you will get some of what you want, and you will get a lot more than you would ever get by using force. And that has been almost entirely missing from the Israeli policy, that something that's analogous to that. And I think, look, was it Leo Durocher or Yogi Berra, one of these guys, the one said, you can't beat something with nothing. If you want to demonstrate that what Hamas is doing is futile, that the use of violence, the politically inspired violence, is not only immoral, but will be counterproductive for realizing Palestinian ambitions, you have to, yes, push back against Hamas. But you've got to show there's a better way. You've got to show that for those Palestinians willing to meet certain conditions, they can actually deliver certain things. But so far, at least, this Israeli government has not been willing to open a political track.
And you listed out some steps that Israel could take going forward. What are they?
Well, among other things, I would want to see the Israelis, again, at the risk of slightly repeating myself, be much more measured in its use of military force henceforth, open up more land routes to allow aid in. I think on the political side, to start the conversation, to basically say, look, we're potentially open to realizing some Palestinian political ambitions, even conceivably down the road, a separate state. But here's some of the conditions you've got to meet. You know, it's got to be a demilitarized state. You've got to rule out the use of political violence. The Israelis also have to show their bona fides here. I would say to rein in settler, not just settler violence, but rein in settlements. The problem with settlements is they essentially take off the table territory. And territory is not everything, but territory is one critical dimension of any political conversation or negotiation you're going to have. So Israel would have to do that. Obviously, this Israeli government is unwilling to do that. So, you know, and I think what I've been arguing is the United States needs to, in some ways, present these choices, get them out into the Israeli body politic. I get it. After October 7th, it's psychologically, emotionally, extraordinarily difficult. We've got to be very careful about how we do this. Israel is an entire society, essentially, with PTSD for good reason, for so many good reasons. But I do think, essentially, we have to help the Israelis begin to make the transition from what I would call the world of October 7th to the world of October 8th.
Now, you're an influential voice in American policymaking, and for a while now, you've been saying that President Biden should go to the Knesset and speak directly to the Israeli people about his disagreements with their prime minister, Bibi Netanyahu. How is that proposal being received by the Biden administration?
I think the idea of going to the Knesset's probably not going to happen. I like the idea, the symbolism of it. I'll be honest with you. Part of it was what's good for the goose is good for the gander. After Bibi Netanyahu came here on the floor of the Congress and essentially, you know, talked against the Iran nuclear deal, I like the idea of a president of the United States going to the Knesset to go over the head of the prime minister and this government. A lot of people who know Israel well said that's probably a mistake. You could have a lot of heckling. I actually thought that would be an opportunity for the president. Imagine the following scenario where Joe Biden were on the floor of the Knesset and some people started heckling as they would. Imagine if he had said, shame on you. I represent the United States of America. Over the decades, we have been Israel's most stalwart friend. We have provided this much economic aid, this much military aid. We have vetoed resolutions against you however many times. We are there with you. And just because we disagree with you on a matter of policy doesn't mean that we are not there with you or for you. So I actually would have welcomed that. My sense is it might be too risky for the administration. So I think the real question is whether, and if so, how, the president builds on what he began to say in the State of the Union and at other times. I think he needs to go further. I think the president's posture so far has been, what, a kind of disappointed uncle. I really care for you, Israel, but I think you're making some mistakes. I think some of what you're doing is counterproductive. The president, though, has been somewhat reluctant to go much further than that. And I think he needs to, both with words, but also with policies.
Does it strike you that there's like an emerging generational divide in how Americans look at what's going on in the Middle East, but also within the State Department, within the White House even?
I think you're onto something. I think so. Presidents of a generation that saw and sees Israel in some ways from the beginning, from the founding. It saw the connection between the Holocaust and the creation of a Jewish state. It remembers when Israel was very much David to Goliath. I remember when I was a teenager, you had the cover of Life magazine, and you had two young Israeli soldiers born in Israel, Sabras, on the cover. And there was a sense of America rooting for the underdog, rooting for Israel. I think, yeah, that's where the president's generation is. I think then probably people, if I'm off over the line here, forgive me, closer to your generation, younger than the president, younger than me, people in their, you know, 40s, 50s, what have you. And I hope I haven't done you any slander there.
None.
Who have a slightly more nuanced view. It's not as emotionally attached to Israel. A little bit more, yeah, we're supportive, but there's a but. There's always a but. And then I think there's a younger generation, probably closer to late teens, 20s, 30s, which essentially sees Israel quite critically, almost only critically. Doesn't understand much about the history. Doesn't see what Israel has accomplished. Doesn't know, for example, the history of negotiations where Israel has offered things only to have the Palestinians turn them down. Sees Israel through the prism or lens, I think, badly flawed of groups like Black Lives Matter. Sees Israel as the colonial occupying power. And there, there's precious little, if any, sympathy. So to answer your question, yes, I do think there's a real generational divide. And I worry about that because think about it, it's obvious. As we move into the future, people who have these more one-dimensional critical views of Israel are going to increasingly be the powerful, influential people in this society. It's one of the reasons that I worry about Israeli policy. I think it's short-sighted in dismissing what is the real erosion of the pro-Israel instinctive leaning and sympathy in the United States.
So building on that, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, gave a speech last week that in many ways is seen as a watershed of sorts. This is the highest ranking Jewish American in government, stalwart backer of Israel for decades. And, you know, he made an appeal to the Israeli people to look beyond Netanyahu. I imagine that appeal on his part took a lot of courage. Will it change anything?
It did take a lot of courage, and I think the Israelis will dismiss it at their peril. It's a little bit of a canary in a coal mine, or choose your metaphor. The fact, as you say, that Chuck Schumer, given his history, given who he is, given his generation, would say those things is, to me, quite telling. I thought some of what he did was over the line or probably counterproductive. I think he made a mistake by making it so much about Bibi Netanyahu, too ad hominem, which is never a good idea. I think he made a mistake by telling Israelis, or advising them rather, to have new elections. I never get comfortable when we get inside the political processes of others. What I think he ought to have limited himself to doing, and it's what I think President Biden ought to be doing, is just focus on the policy. Just say where you disagree and why, and what it is you'd like to see and why. Explain, educate, do it with sympathy, if you will. But try to stay away from the personality, because quite honestly, this transcends Bibi Netanyahu. It's not only that our attacking him, for all I know, could help him politically. He could stand up and say, I'm the only person in Israel who's strong enough. You may not like me, but I can push back against the United States. But look at the demographic changes in Israel. Look at the political shifts in Israel over recent decades. There's really not a left anymore. And so you could technically get rid of Bibi Netanyahu, and you may not get something qualitatively different, much less better. So I would couch it in policy terms, not in personal terms.
Now, there's one part of Schumer's speech that I think isn't getting enough attention. He referenced Israel testing, quote unquote, existing U.S. standards for assistance. And I think that could have been a reference to the Leahy Law, which says the U.S. can't give military aid to countries that commit gross human rights violations. Right. How significant was that?
Well, I think if the Israelis go ahead with their assault into Rafah and there are large numbers of civilian casualties, I think you will see something like that. That we won't deny certain types of arms, but we may say, here are the end user controls. That if you want to, you know, so we may still provide Israel with certain kinds of munitions, but say you can't use them in these ways. Or if you do use them in these ways, we won't provide anything more of this sort. For example, large several thousand pound bombs. Or we may prioritize providing Israel with targeted munitions, which by definition are much less likely to cause certain types of collateral damage. I think there could be pressure on Israel if it interferes with aid deliveries. Again, there's other aspects. So yeah, I think what we're moving towards is a more conditional relationship rather than a blank check. And I could also imagine, and I wrote about it in the article in the Wall Street Journal, is that the president would start talking about the principles that ought to inform a political process, a political track. I can imagine at some point the United States going to the United Nations Security Council and say, here, we need to introduce a resolution that updates or supplements or complements, choose your word, UN 242, that we basically ought to take the diplomatic process into the next era. I've also been thinking about maybe at some point we have a new version of the Madrid Peace Conference. I was at that one after the Gulf War in October of 1991. It was the first time, people may recall, or maybe not, that Arabs and Israelis sat face to face discussing peace. We may want to do something like that at some point once we do have a new resolution. We need to restart a diplomatic process. You can't succeed here if there's only a military dimension to policy. Oh yeah, if we're looking simply at a long-term occupation of Gaza, coupled with a long-term occupation of the West Bank, and we're hoping that local notables or influentials are gonna step up, you've gotta be kidding. That's not gonna happen. They'll be seen as collaborators, and there'll still be elements of resistance on the ground that'll kill them. So there's gotta be a political process that's seen as legitimate, that's respected in the Arab world and in the Palestinian world. That's the way to marginalize Hamas.
And I think a through line in our conversation so far is the issue of leverage. I mean, how much leverage does the White House have, and then how much it's willing to use?
It's a good question. You know, historically, you would have said the White House had very little leverage, because most of the political weight in this country, getting back to the chapeau of our conversation about foreign policy in an election year, most of the pressure would have been, quote unquote, being pro-Israel. And we could have a conversation about what does that actually mean nowadays. But also it pushes the other way. And that's what we've seen in Michigan. That's what we've seen with a younger generation. So I actually think the domestic context in which Middle East policy is made has really shifted over the last few decades. And we saw it in some ways in the reaction to Schumer's comments, the Republican reaction, jumping on him, saying it's unacceptable, we've got to stand by Israel unconditionally, and a lot of the Democratic reaction being fairly laudatory or at least complimentary. I don't know, though, how much leverage. My guess is the Israelis are pretty much going to do what they're going to do. And Bibi Netanyahu, who my own guess is he's calculated that there's a lot of public support for what he wants in Israel, and that one way or another, if there's damage here down the road, he can attend to that. So my guess is American attempts at leverage, even if we do condition certain arms, even if we do sanction the odd settler, even if we support a resolution in the Security Council, I don't think we're going to turn the Israelis around. There's a whole history, and I've been thinking about this, of major powers and their friends and smaller powers or middle-sized countries. And in many cases, the ability of the stronger country to leverage that strength to get the other party to do what it wants, it turns out to be more limited than one might think.
And you are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, in addition to a range of other benefits, including our magazine. Sign up, use the code FPLIVE for a discount.
Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's stick with the notion of how in an election year, public pressure can maybe shift foreign policy along the margins. And we've been talking a lot about what should happen or what leaders and policymakers are proposing, but how much does polling matter? So for example, even US views of Israel are at their lowest point in about 20 years, still at around 58% or so, but it has declined. And you mentioned the Arab Americans in Michigan. Surely that is playing a significant role in the shift in rhetoric that we're seeing.
I think it's partially, you know, the politics of it, partially also people are genuinely moved by what they see. You know, radical notion, policy is made by policymakers, and policymakers are people too. So it's not just, I think, people with putting their finger in the wind and saying which way are the polls going. And I think in this case, there's people who are friendly towards Israel, inclined to support Israel, and think what Israel's doing is making enormous mistakes. I would put myself in that category, that I support Israel, I care about Israel. I just worry about the near, medium, and long-term consequences of Israeli policy. But you know, coming back to your larger point, yeah, I think this is probably the one foreign policy issue this year that's caught up in domestic politics. In part, again, because you've got certain populations of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans concentrated in certain areas, particularly if they happen to be swing states. You've got young people. Even before October 7th, there was some concern about the administration's ability to get out younger Democrats and younger voters. This has probably exacerbated that. But my guess is this is probably the exception. When I think about this election, even like people like you and me, we spend our time debating Ukraine or debating Taiwan or so forth. I don't see those issues showing up much in political behavior. The most recent Gallup poll, I think, said only 3% of Americans cited foreign policy as the issue that they thought was most important. Issues like immigration were incomparably more significant and salient for most Americans. It's one of the ironies of this campaign. Is that foreign policy will barely figure in the campaign, and the consequences of the campaign for foreign policy, both the process as well as the result, are enormous. And it's another disconnect, if you will, between what's happening in this country and the rest of the world.
And if you were to sort of take a step back a little bit, look at recent American history, how much does public opinion usually matter in an election year for foreign policy? And is 2024 different in that regard?
I think public opinion matters more in foreign policy when the United States is heavily involved in something and it's not going well. And that's, you know, things like Vietnam during the late 60s and early 70s, or Iraq at times and so forth. I think there's, you know, when wars prove to be costly, in every sense of the word costly, in human terms, in economic terms, foreign policy moves up when there's real disaffection. That and then you see, for example, I remember 68 pressures for bombing halts and so forth. Or during the Cold War, more generally, foreign policy figured more prominently simply because foreign policy, not just during election years, but day in, day out, figured more prominently. So I remember, you know, debates, silly debates about missile gaps and the rest actually mattered. I think now in this post-Cold War world, the salience of foreign policy has gone down in terms of people's perceptions. And when the United States, such as now, when we're not involved on the ground with significant costs, I actually don't think foreign policy matters much to voters. It's one of the reasons that I think the Ukraine situation, it's been slightly more of a, pardon the expression, but an elite preoccupation rather than a popular one, even though I fear the consequences of what we are doing or now not doing are potentially enormous. But I don't see it figuring all that centrally in the campaign. The one issue that young people really cared about other than the Middle East, certainly before October 7th, was climate. And what I haven't seen a lot of evidence that that's going to have all that much of an impact, but maybe, because they are the differences between Donald Trump and Joe Biden are, shall we say, stark. And the other reason, probably, sorry to go on so long, foreign policy won't matter that much is in some areas there's considerable similarity. Think about it. Both candidates have, shall we say, limited enthusiasm for trade. Both candidates oppose the United States staying in Afghanistan. Both are very tough on China. You know, again, there's differences of degree and in the specifics, but on some important foreign policy issues, there's not a whole lot of fundamental difference between the two. You see the differences more on Ukraine and Russia, and you potentially could see some of the differences more on how to deal with Israel, and I already mentioned climate.
We're getting some terrific questions from our subscribers around the world. Let me take one of them from Joseph Yackley at the State Department, and he asks if you can touch on the growing partisan divide over U.S. foreign policy and how U.S. allies are adjusting to the fact that many key U.S. initiatives now effectively come with expiration dates.
It's a thoughtful question. Let me answer it this way. If you look at the history of U.S. presidential elections in the modern era, what I'm struck by, and even if we didn't quite realize it at the time, was how the similarities between the Republican and Democratic candidates far outweighed any differences. Taking the 64 election between Johnson and Barry Goldwater, we thought the differences were pronounced. They're actually quite modest. Donald Trump and Joe Biden, though, it's just the opposite. The differences are much greater in many cases than the similarities. America first versus alliance first. Big difference with NATO and other countries. Differences about how to deal with authoritarian regimes. Differences about democracy. Possibly differences about Israel. And we could go on. So the rest of the world, and I've been traveling a lot recently, is in some ways unnerved. There was always a presumption that there would be far more continuity than change, regardless of the outcome of a presidential election. And for the first time, a lot of Europeans or Asians and others are waking up to that. That may no longer be true. And this has been unnerving. And what you're seeing are different kinds of conversations all over the world about how do they carry out a foreign policy where America plays a less central role. And you see different conversations. Some countries are talking about, can we become more self-reliant? Others are beginning to search for new security partners. Say, can we turn to others in Europe to take the place? Some aren't talking about it, but my guess is they're looking at how do they maybe accommodate a powerful neighbor if they don't quite have the United States sure to have their back. So we're looking at, I think almost no matter what happens, the presumption of American continuity has been shattered to some extent. And people aren't sure even what Trumpism without Trump looks like down the road. So the question is being asked in ways it was never asked before. But certainly, Robbie, if Donald Trump were to be elected, then yes, I think we're beginning to look at allies and partners no longer nearly as confident on us, no longer sure they can depend on us. You know, we were talking before about our mutual friend, Fareed Zakaria. You know, Fareed wrote about the post-American world, and a lot of Fareed's analysis was about what he called the rise of the rest. What I think is so interesting is, in addition to that, what we have is the pulling back of us, much more than he and others anticipated, is that this is something we're essentially doing to ourselves. So this is not about the rise of China or Russia or Iran or North Korea or anybody else. This is about the United States choosing to play a less substantial role in the world. And that is something that's very different. And our allies are essentially asking themselves, how do we navigate such a world where the United States counts for less?
Yeah, and indeed, America might be accelerating the arrival of a post-American world. Switching topics a little bit. So the third Summit for Democracy is underway in Seoul this week. And this is an initiative that Biden started 3 years ago. It's often generated criticism in large part because of who gets invited and who doesn't. It wasn't intended to be a referendum, but it sort of conveys the message that Washington has a black and white view of democracies. And there's a school of thought now that hosting it in Seoul this week was a way of distancing the White House from it. And you could also sense this from Biden's State of the Union, where instead of talking about democracies versus autocracies, he sort of reframed his broader theme as one of freedom, whether it's freedom in Ukraine or reproductive freedom. What do you make of that?
In full disclosure, I never liked the idea of putting democracy at the center of American foreign policy. If we want to promote democracy, let's make democracy here work. If people see an American democracy that protects rights, that delivers, creates a context of law and order, where economic life goes on well and so forth. The American people are better off. That's the best advertisement we could ever make for democracy. And no amount of talking points given to diplomats can come close to competing with it. I think also Ukraine showed the problems of having a democracy-centric foreign policy. We need countries to support us, whether they're democracies or not. Why do we want to make that a dividing line? We want everybody to support us, say, on sanctioning Russia. Why do we care whether they're democracies or not in this instance? So just see, or on climate change or any number of other issues. Why should? So I would say basically we ought to be promoting democracies around the world, mainly by example, where we can help them in other ways, fine. But it ought not to be a demarcation line or a grouping or a way we approach the world. I don't think we can have one foreign policy for democracies and others for non-democracies. That said, all that said, I do like the idea, though, that Seoul is hosting this. And let me just say why. I think South Korea is one of the amazing stories. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, if you look at the sweep of history over the last, 30, 40, 50 years. I remember when I first visited South Korea in the 70s, every time I went, I would be caught up in tear gas because there'd be demonstrations in Seoul, demonstrations on campuses. You had essentially military rule. And so when I look at South Korea today, it's one of the world's most vibrant democracies. It's one of the world's, 12 or so largest economies. It's a real partner of the United States, not just on the peninsula, but increasingly beyond. It's an amazing success story. So I like the idea that's in this. So even though I don't like, if you will, putting democracy at the center of American foreign policy, I do think it's really fitting that South Korea, more formally the Republic of Korea, is hosting this event.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more there. I was actually in Seoul last week, and it strikes me that you mentioned 1970. Back then, South Korea had a GDP per capita that was about India's. And today, you're probably looking at a GDP per capita that might be 15x more than India's. So yeah, it really is a pretty stunning turnaround.
I agree. And one other thing on South Korea, since I'm in, handing out compliments, I think what South Korea and Japan have done over the last year or two in essentially coming to terms with their historical feud over Japanese occupation and the treatment of Korean women and others has really been a rare act of statesmanship and diplomacy. And I think the leadership of both South Korea and Japan deserve real kudos for their willingness to tackle these difficult and often controversial subjects. You know, when I give talks, as I expect you do, people say, well, do you have anything positive to say? Because it's a pretty depressing litany that those of us in this business, and this is one of the examples. I actually think this shows what leadership can do and the willingness of leaders in some ways to lead, to go out, to shape public opinion rather than just follow public opinion. And I think both countries, Japan and South Korea, deserve a lot of credit here.
Yeah. So I wanted to come to Ukraine, and we started with a bit of an elections theme today. So let me combine the two. It seems to me that despite the fact that Americans remain broadly supportive of helping Ukraine, Congress isn't really able to do that. What do you expect to change on that front this year?
The honest answer is I don't know, and it's scandalous. It was Michael Kinsley who once said, you know, what's truly scandalous in Washington is what's legal. There's nothing illegal about this, but it's scandalous. The idea that we would pull the rug out from under Ukraine after all that they and we collectively have accomplished over the last 2 years, talk about snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. Now, Ukraine may not have helped itself, I think, by overreaching in its definition of success, by saying they were going to, you know, liberate every last inch of Ukrainian territory. That's not going to happen. I'm not saying they should give up on that goal, but they're not going to achieve it that way. So I think they raised some doubts about the efficacy of military aid. But let's not kid ourselves. The opponents of military aid aren't about, you know, let's say, taking a little bit off of it, shaving this off or use it in this way. They're just isolationists, or they have this romantic attachment to Russia for reasons that baffle me, or both. So I don't know how you turn this around, because it's actually a rare example of foreign policy that Congress has the upper hand. And 90% of foreign policy, the president, the executive branch has the upper hand. But this is an example because it's so tied to providing, you know, arms, and this requires money, that it's right in the wheelhouse of Congress. I don't know how you change that unless a few Republicans essentially are willing to put country before party and politics. And that's what it'll take to basically do an end run around this speaker. And I don't understand all the details of discharge petitions and the like, but there are mechanisms for getting there. What I'm hoping is there's some kind of a compromise where rather than 60 odd billion, you get 40 odd billion. Choose a number arbitrarily. You get a hell of a lot more than 300 million though, which is what we got the other day from the Pentagon. So you get something really significant and we give Ukraine enough to reverse the most recent trend, which is gradual Russia grinding them down. So, and what's at stake here is not just Ukraine, it's Europe, it's the American position in the world, going back to our previous conversation. How do you think this looks to Taiwan and others? You know, it's interesting. The Republicans want to say how tough they are on China. Well, here's a chance to show it. Give Ukraine what it needs.
Indeed. I'm getting a lot of subscriber questions on Trump as it relates to some of the things you were just describing. And Trump is often described as someone who has a gut instinct for what people want, whether or not he actually believes the United States should retreat from the world, from alliances, from global pacts. His basic instinct is likely derived from some sense of what people want. Do you think that's fair? And if so, I mean, how serious is that strain, you know, the isolationist strain or the strongman appeal strain? How serious is that in American society?
A couple reactions. You know, I've had conversations with Donald Trump over the years, including when he was running last time. He does believe in a few things pretty strongly. I don't agree with him, but they're not opportunistic. He hates trade. He basically thinks trade rips us off. He thinks allies are free riders who rip the United States. Well, he has a certain foreign policy of populism, of resentment, that a lot of what we do in the world costs us more than benefits us. And that's his take on the world. And I've tried to argue otherwise. And let me say, I didn't make a dent, not even close. You know, we were once talking about one of my books, Foreign Policy Begins at Home. And he said, no, I really like that title. And I said, yeah, but Donald, the title is Foreign Policy Begins at Home. It doesn't end there. It's almost like he didn't want to finish it. But look, those, I think, on his part, I think they're wrong, but I think they are sincere. I would say the isolationist impulse, which tracks pretty closely with that, the idea that whatever it is you do in the world isn't worth it. I think he's good at reading a room. And in this case, the room is America. And I think he sees it there. And it never disappears. It's like a virus or a recessive gene, whatever the medical metaphor is. It's always there and it comes out at certain times. Ironically, it's come out now, I think, in part because there are so many domestic problems. And the irony is, yes, we have domestic problems from the border to our schools to you name it. But our problem is not that we don't spend enough. We spend a lot on all these things, including entitlements, but those are off the table and so forth. So, but I think Trump is capitalizing on the sense that we ought to be doing more here. What we do over there is a waste, the worst yet. You know, one of the real legacies of the Iraq War was that it discredited elites and in some ways discredited a discretionary foreign policy. Iraq will go down as one of the most costly wars of choice in American history. So I think that also feeds into it. So I think Trump's, look, he's a politician. And he's sensing that's where the mood of the country is. I think he's not far wrong. If only 3% thinks foreign policy is the most critical challenge facing the United States, I think he's reading the room pretty correctly. And there's probably one other thing. This will come as a real shock to you. I hope you're sitting down there. No, yeah, rumor has it he has, shall we say, rather a healthy dose of confidence in his own abilities. And so I think he likes the idea that he can get allies to pay more or cut a deal with this or that authoritarian figure. He likes the drama and the personal dimension of diplomacy, the North Korean thing being a metaphor or just a case study in that. But so I don't know to what extent his foreign policy views are opportunistic or deeply held, but either way, I think you do see, it's protectionist, it's much more critical of allies, and it is much more limited in what the United States is going to be prepared to do in the world.
Last question. You pretty much know everyone who goes in and out of government, at least in the foreign policy sense. And there were some principled old hands who tried to join his administration in 2016, thinking that they'd stave off the worst. How does that play out this year, were he to secure another term? How worried are you about the people who could work in a Trump administration?
Well, I am worried about it because so many of the more establishment figures who went in last time around, if there's Trump 2.0, my guess is there aren't going to be those people this time around for the most part. They were discouraged by what happened to the Jim Mattises or H.R. McMasters and so forth. So I don't know, who would have the big job. Bob Lighthizer, the trade rep, would have a big job somewhere. I would think we hear about people like Rick Grenell and Robert O'Brien. So I think you get some people who are in the first term. What worries me is you probably won't have people who are prepared to do what senior people have to do, which is to walk into the small office off the Oval and say, this is crazy, or you shouldn't do this. And it's the kind of thing I often describe as the Jim Baker role. You need people of standing who are willing to tell the president why they disagree and to give it to him with the bark off the tree. And what worries me is rather than having this, if there's a second go around, you'll have people more who are enablers, who are accelerators, if you will, of Trumpism. And if they actually do gut the bureaucracy in the way the Heritage Foundation wants, I worry about it both from the top down and the ground up. People forget that the word bureaucracy wasn't originally a dirty word. It was a positive word. It was meant as a certain presumption of continuity, of something conservative, of quality control, of constraint. And I worry about a Trump, if you will, unimpeded. And dramatic changes in foreign policy make me really nervous. We've done so well for 75 years. I'm not saying we don't need adjustment or changes. Of course we do. But dramatic changes or wholesale changes, my instincts in almost every case would be not. But I worry that we could have an administration whose inclination, whose default position is going to be wholesale change. And given how well the world has worked for 75 years for the most part, I worry about where that could take us.
If you're worried, we're all worried too. Richard Haass, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Robbie.
And that was Richard Haass, the President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. As always, if you want to know who's coming up in future episodes of FP Live, head to foreignpolicy.com. I'm Ravi Agrawal. I'll see you next time.
The first teller of my story is me.
This week on Disorder.
In this new world, when military power will be connected with high tech, small states can be very, very powerful.
Could small states help order the world?
Small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones.
To find out, we're joined by Dr. Armen Sarkisian, Armenia's former president and prime minister.
In our two-part series, we discuss the history of the Armenian genocide,
the ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh,
and why small states could be the answer to the disorder in our world.
The big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
You can get Disorder wherever you get your podcasts, or you can follow the link in the show notes.